A reading from the sixth chapter of the Gospel according to John. After this, Jesus went to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, also called the Sea of Tiberias. A large crowd kept following him because they saw the signs that he was doing for the sick. And so Jesus went up the mountain and sat down there with his disciples. Now, the Passover, that is, the festival of the Jews, was near. And when he looked up and saw a large crowd coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread for these people to eat?" Jesus said this to test him, for he himself knew what he was going to do. Philip answered him, 6 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each of them to get a little." One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "Well, there is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are they among so many people?" Jesus said, "Make the people sit down." Now there was a great deal of grass in that place, so they sat down, about 5,000 in all. And then Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they were satisfied, Jesus told his disciples, "Gather up the fragments left over so that nothing may be lost." So they gathered them up. And from the fragments of the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten, they filled 12 baskets. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they began to say, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." This is the word of God for the people of God.
My family and I had the privilege of living in the Middle East for about a decade. We raised our children there. And we lived in the Sultanate of Oman. And one of the things you discover when you live in that place is there's this radical sense of hospitality. And what that means is you discover quickly that if you're in someone's home and you admire something too profusely, and they sense that it will bring you joy, then they feel this obligation to give it to you. So I had many a home early on that I walked out with knickknacks and paintings. And so you teach yourself not to be too effusive when you admire something. Well, we were at a restaurant that we went to every week on Wednesday night to do, of all things in the Middle East, country line dancing. It's another story, I'll tell you another time. But we would go there and we'd do country line dancing, and we met people there and made friends there. And there was an Omani that we saw every Wednesday night. And then one time I noticed he had on this watch, beautiful watch, but it had on it the Royal Omani symbol. And when that caught my eye, I started to admire his watch. I couldn't catch myself. And I said, "Oh, that watch, it's so beautiful. And it even has a symbol of Oman." And then I added, "Boy, I'd love to have a watch like that one day. Because if I had a watch like that, then I could remember what this country has meant to me and my family." And then he simply said, "It would be wonderful if you had such a watch." And that was the end. Now, I have to say, I've tried admiring other things. I've admired Mercedes and Ferraris and Lamborghinis profusely. I would say, "Oh, what a beautiful car, and a poor, simple pastor such as myself will never own one." And to which the response was always the same, "Boss, you're not getting my car." But 1 week later, back to the story, I get a call from that same gentleman. He said, "I'd love for you to come over to my home for coffee." And so we arranged a time, and I went to his home, and I walked through, and he took me to his study, and he sat at his desk, and while we're talking, he's reaching in the drawer, and he pulls out a box, and it's a watch. And on it is the Royal Omani symbol. He had gotten it from the royal court. And then he handed it to me, and he opened it, and he said, "You said you would like a watch like this, and you deserve one. You need to have one. So here, this is for you." Now, I was embarrassed. I shouldn't have admired his watch like that. I know the culture. And so I tried my hardest to say, "I cannot accept this watch. It's too much," even though I really wanted it. It was too much. And finally, he said this to me. I want someone to take this watch, wear this watch, and enjoy this watch. And if it's not you, then take it and give it to someone else. But it's not staying here. And so I finally said, I'll take it, which I have on right now. Now, this watch, every time I would wear it and he would see me wearing it, there was this glimmer in his eye, knowing that he had given me something. He had entrusted me with something that brought so much joy to me. It brought so much joy to him. And I wonder, isn't that what it's like with God who created us? This God who has given us these amazing gifts, just hoping that we'll open up our lives and see them and use them, because that would bring God joy. There is a saying from St. Irenaeus from the second century. He was a theologian, and he said this: the glory of God is a human being fully alive. And our joy is found, our happiness is found, in being fully alive to the things that God has created us to do and to be. They're just waiting for us there. And so I thought it would be important, because there's so much at stake in this, if we just take a couple of weeks to look at what it means to be entrusted with these gifts, these abilities, these strengths from God, and what it might mean if we open up our lives and see them and use them, not only to bring joy to God, but to bring joy to ourselves. Now, to do this, I want to look at this curious passage that was read. And now you're thinking, the feeding of the 5,000, entrusted gifts, what on earth do these two things have to do with one another? I know it seems odd, but there's something in here that I think is so important for us related to this topic. Now, with the feeding of the 5,000, it's a very famous and popular story. In fact, it occurs in all four accounts in the Gospels. There's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and it's in every single one of them. But of course, each account is different. It includes some things the others doesn't, and sometimes it emphasizes different things or includes different things to make a point. And so what I want to do is look at this passage, because there's a few things in the account in the Gospel of John that are different than the other three accounts. And they're very important for us to understand the meaning of this passage. Now, to make sure everybody understands what's happening here, make no assumptions about how famous it might be in our own understanding. This is a passage about the teaching of Jesus, and in that time, anyone who could offer healing and hope was a rock star. And they had a huge following. Places that could offer healing and hope became a pilgrimage site. So if there were hot springs that people reported were healing, people were there. Remember, this is a time when healthcare was different. Infant mortality rate was high. Death rate was high. Sickness was high. And so they were looking for a place to find healing. Enter the story of Jesus, who is known to be this figure who is offering so much healing and hope to people, and so people are flocking to him, and they're following him. At this point, it's up to 5,000. And so Jesus and the disciples are trying to get away. They've been with him for several days, and it's time to take a break, and they pull away, but everyone follows. Now, Jesus, having this radical sense of hospitality that I just mentioned, understands that if they're following us and they're here, we need to take care of them. We need to feed them. And so in this moment, this passage unfolds telling what happens in the attempt to feed these people. But in the Gospel of John, it tells it a bit differently, and there's three things that come up that I think represent our human tendencies that limit ourselves, that keep us stuck right where we are. And being aware of those, there's a pathway forward that helps us unleash the things that we have to move beyond where we are. So let's look at the passage carefully. And if you want to, it's on page 867 in your pew Bibles. If you want to follow along in the verses, I'm just kind of walk through a couple of verses here and note some things for you. So one of the things we notice right off that's different than the other accounts is that it mentions in verse 1 that this is by the Sea of Galilee, but then it adds something that's not mentioned in the other accounts. It says it's the Sea of Tiberias. Now, this is important because the people then would know, Tiberias, that's that awful city that no one wants to be a part. You see, this city was formed just a few years before this incident. And when it was formed, it was supposed to be a bridge for trade, and it was established by the Roman occupiers. And they built it on a local Jewish graveyard. And so for observant Jews, it was not a place you could go. It was unclean. Really, in their minds, when they heard the name Tiberias, it represented the place you never wanted to visit, you never wanted to live, and nothing good could ever come of that place. But yet in John, it says, remember, we're near that place. There's people from that place that may be here. And so we encounter this first human tendency that we want to count out the possibilities that we have because of the place that we're in. And so right off the bat, John establishes, whoever you are, wherever you're from, as bad as it may be, whatever place you find yourself in, literally or figuratively, know this, that you should not discount the possibilities that are about to happen because of the place you are in. And then we move on in this passage. We get to verse 5. And there, this is fascinating to me. In all the other accounts, the three other accounts, Jesus simply says, when the crowd's there, go feed them. He already had a plan. He knew they'd be perplexed, but that's all part of the teaching here. But in this account, John presents it differently. Jesus asks a question. He doesn't say, go feed them. He says this, where do we go to buy the food so that they have something to eat? And in the Greek, you could say, where is the place we can look to find the resources that we need to help them? Or in the slang, you could just say, what do we have to work with here, people? And so he asked this question. Now notice Philip's response. Philip doesn't say, well, we could look here or there, or the farthest market is a long ways away, Jesus. No, Philip changes the question, and he bases his answer on that. His response is to the question, how much will it cost? Right? He doesn't look for what they have to work with. It's like, do you realize, Jesus, this is going to cost us over a half of your salary minimum? That's ludicrous. We don't have that kind of money. How on earth could we ever begin to meet this need? He begins with costs. The Jesus question wasn't about cost. It was, what do we have to work with? And so the second thing that's being taught here is that too often we count the costs before we consider the possibilities. How many times do we do that? That we have a challenge or opportunity before us and we begin to count the cost. How much time, how much energy, how much money, and immediately we dismiss it. How many things have we walked away from because we count the cost before we considered the possibilities? And then we move further in the passage to verses 8 and 9. Andrew's been listening to all this, and he seems to get it. In the midst of the overwhelming need, which it seems they'll never be able to supply, Andrew says, well, Jesus, there is this little boy here, and he has 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, probably large dried minnows. That's what we have to work with. What Andrew was saying in that moment was that he wasn't going to count out the possibilities that they have because of the size of the resources in their possession. And how many times do we do that? And that's the whole point of this passage, that sometimes from the littlest things that we're willing to give, the greatest of things grow. And there's 2 ways that people have interpreted this passage, which are fascinating to me. One is this, that all they had was the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, and Jesus took them and blessed them, and out of this little thing, he just began breaking them and distributing them, and to everyone's surprise, it was enough to feed everyone, all 5,000, as a reminder that sometimes out of the little thing, if you're willing to let it go, it just grows and it grows and it grows, if you release it. But there's another interpretation. And this interpretation goes is that when the 5,000 were following Jesus and they're all settling down, they look around and realize, there's a lot of hungry people. Hide our food. And so they started hiding their food in their robes and in their bags so that they could keep it for themselves. And then this little boy, out of naivete, he doesn't understand all this. He said, well, I have some loaves and some fish, if it helps. And so Jesus took them from the little boy and started passing them out. And one by one, the people started opening up their robes and their bags and pulling out their loaves and their fish and sharing. And what they discovered is if they would all do that, if they would let go of what they had and give it, they had more than enough for everyone. Whatever interpretation you use for this passage, it points us to the same thing, that if we try to hoard what we have and keep it, we'll never have enough. It will never feel like it. But when we release and give what we have, it has a way of growing, and the blessings grow, and we have more than we ever imagined. So what can we do about these human tendencies? What is the way forward for us all, individually and collectively? And for me, it comes down to this, a way for us to think about this. It's about being a container or a conduit. If we have a container mentality, it means when we receive things, we put them in the container and we try to keep them and hoard them because they are for ourselves. And the conduit mentality says, these blessings I have, I cannot hold to myself. I'm going to let them go. And we discover this river of blessings that flows through us and just seems to grow. And the question for us all is, do we want to be containers or do we want to be conduits? I know I struggle with container mentality. After a worship service one Sunday, I was walking down the street, and a guy was trying to get my attention desperately. And he said, hey, can you help me out? Do you have some cash? To which my answer is always, no. Partly because I never have cash, and partly because I don't know what it'll be used for. It's just part of my personal policy. And I said, why? What do you need it for? And he came up to me and he said, I have a job interview tomorrow, and I don't have anything to wear. And I said, well, what do you need? And he said, well, a tie, fixated on my tie. And as he stands there staring at my tie, I had a container mentality. I thought, this is a gift. It's a fairly expensive tie. It's mine. Maybe he can wait here. I can go home and get one of my cheap ties, and we can work this out. But I had to break free from that. And so in that moment, I realized the right thing to do was say, if you want this tie, it's yours. And so I took it off, I gave it to him, and off he went. I hope he got the job. But it's so hard for me to move out of that container mentality. And then I read about someone this week who has a conduit mentality. Her name is Michelle Lee. She's a librarian on the Upper West Side. Maybe you saw the article. She's done something amazing. Every year, she speaks with young people about finding jobs, how to apply for jobs, how to conduct yourself in an interview, and she discovered that many of them don't have the things they need to go to that interview. They don't have ties or handbags or briefcases, the things to hold their stuff in. So she had this crazy idea. What if we collect those things at the library and someone could come in with their library card and check out a tie or check out what they need and have it for 3 weeks? And so now on the Upper West Side, with your library card, you can check out a tie or a bag, some of the things you need to prepare yourself for an interview. That is a conduit mentality. And it's remarkable, but one idea that she held, she let go, and how many people will it help, and how will that idea spread to other places? It's amazing to me. And while we think about our own lives being containers or conduits, we need to think about who we are as a church and what we have here, the many blessings. I don't know about you, but from the day I stepped in this place, I felt the weight, the responsibility of this glorious past that we have and the way it's blessed so many people. When I walked in here on this first Sunday, walking up here, I tried so hard to be dignified, and it didn't work. I didn't realize the steps are steep, and I started tripping on my robe. I almost went down that first Sunday. And then I got up, and I don't know if you noticed, we do synchronized seating here. So we come up, we line up, and all together, we sit down. And so all together, we sat down, and I find myself slouching forward and back like a little kid. And I'm looking around in this moment and thinking this thought. I wonder if Norman Vincent Peale felt like this his first Sunday here. I'm just always mindful of the weight of our past and the things that we've done. I think about the 1850s. When this church relocated up to this place because people were moving north, so they established Marble Collegiate Church here. But yet the church knew that they could not abandon its ministry to the people in the south where they had come from. So they had this idea. We want to continue our ministry there, so what if we appoint someone to help us with that? So they appointed Jeremiah Lamphere in the 1850s. Now, the country was on the brink of economic crisis. People had lost fortunes. Some people were jumping off buildings to take their own lives because they had no hope. And Jeremiah would walk the streets with 30,000 people unemployed. Alcoholism is rampant. And he's wondering, like, what do I have to work with here in the midst of this great need? And so what they decided to do was this. What we have to work with is to call people together in prayer. And so he put out pamphlets everywhere, passed them out to everyone he saw, and he met in a little room that he had rented, and for the first half hour, no one. And then four people came in. But he believed that we need to be a resource and call people to community in prayer, so he just kept showing up, and they kept praying, and within 3 months, there were 50,000 people meeting and praying in New York City from that little movement. Within 18 months, there were millions of people praying in other cities around the country. And it is said from that one little beginning, that one little commitment to that place, from this place, that over 1 million people embraced faith and found healing and hope. That's amazing. That's our past. And then you think about Peel, who came here, struggling church. Again, the economy is struggling. And he had his own self-doubts, and yet he came here. And they were conduits of God, and millions of people's lives have been changed ever since. All because of this place, our history. And you know what the greatest danger is, having that kind of history? That we just want to become a container and put our glorious past into that, and every once in a while take it out so people can see it, but make sure it's preserved and pristine. And here's the question for us all. Do we believe we're called to be containers or conduits? We have a glorious past upon which we can build, and I think we all know the answer. We know we're called to be conduits. We know we're called to open up our lives and see the gifts that we have so that they can be shared with others and they make a difference in people's lives today, tomorrow, in the weeks and months and years to come. We feel that, we know that. And as we think about that through the lens of this passage, here is the great news. If we truly want to be conduits and have God's blessings flow through us and impact people's lives, we have everything we need to do that right here, right now. We have the gifts, we have the resources. The only question is, will we truly be conduits and let go and let it be used by God, or do we want to place it in a container? I think we're all here because we know the answer. We yearn to be that conduit. We want to continue to be that place where lives are changed and transformed. And to that, I think we can all say, amen, let it be so.
Thank you for joining us for Conduits, part one of this series, Entrusted. Please join us next week for part two, Seeds.